Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show. I'm your host, John Dunford. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1315, we feature two stories from new Life Rattle writer, Sadaf Saleem. Sadaf Saleem was born in 1985 in Lahore, Pakistan, where her father was an electrical engineer and her mother a stay-at-home mom. She has two brothers and a sister. The family immigrated to Canada when Sadaf was a teenager and struggled to adjust, but found their footing when her father opened a business in the electrical engineering field. Close to completing her degree in life sciences, Sadaf enjoys the study of human anatomy and physiology, as well as traveling and trying different cuisines. After overcoming her fear that she could not handle languages, Sadaf has discovered a love for writing. Sadaf Saleem was married on August 22nd this year, and she and her husband are living in Ohio for a few months, after which Sadaf intends to pursue the career in healthcare that she has always dreamed of. Whether it's a childhood crisis or adult trauma, Sadaf Saleem's use of interior dialogue gives us great insight into her character's behavior. In tonight's first story, a young girl and her two brothers play unsupervised for the first time with near-fatal results. Let's listen now to Sadaf Saleem's story, Hide and Seek, read by Lori Callis.
Hide and Seek by Sadaf Saleem. I'm 5 years old and live in Lahore, Pakistan. One Thursday night, my older brother Abdullah and younger brother Fahad and I decide to play unsupervised the next morning, before we've even had breakfast. Friday is the only day our parents let us have off. We follow a different schedule every other day of the week, with detailed instructions provided by my parents to our servants about our supervision. When we eat breakfast, when we can watch cartoons, when we can play with our white shih tzu. We've been taught to respect the servants, to listen and obey, and we never disappoint our parents. But I often feel an urge to do something without their supervision. We wake up an hour earlier than planned. The servants remain asleep. We focus on what kind of game we should play. Hide and seek, I scream. No way, Abdullah shouts. That's stupid. Why? Remember how we usually drive Anwar crazy when it's milk time? We hide at places that take him forever to find us. Fahad smiles at Abdullah's reply. Mama appointed Anwar, our youngest servant, to play with us because he finds it easy to mingle. I don't care, I grin. You guys have to listen to me. Why do you do this every time? Abdullah says. Because I'm your only sister. Dad told me to say this whenever Abdullah and Fahad boss me around. It works. But since I pick the game, they make me the seeker. I slowly count to 10. We live in a huge concrete bungalow with 5 bedrooms, 3 full bathrooms, a kitchen, and family, living, dining, and study rooms. A 6-foot-wide hallway divides the 3 bedrooms and storage room on one side from the 2 master bedrooms on the other side. Servant quarters stand at the far end of the gigantic backyard, half the size of a football field. I finish counting and wonder if Abdullah and Fahad are hiding inside or outside. I find Abdullah behind one of the servant quarters. We tiptoe to make sure that no one wakes up and catches us. Abdullah and I search for Fahad, who is only 3 years old. We check the bathrooms, study room, and bedrooms. I look under the beds, study table, settee, and behind the closets and drapes, but can't find him anywhere. Abdullah and I look at each other and tremble when we hear the soft voices of our servants coming from their quarters. Hey, Let's get back to our beds before we get into trouble, I whisper. Are you sure? He asks. Let's go, I say. 10 minutes later, Mom enters our room to wake us up. She doesn't find Fahad in his bed. Is Fahad in the washroom? I don't know, I say. Me neither, says Abdullah. Mom searches for Fahad and then calls out to two of our servants. Anwar, Saqib, come here, quick. They promptly leave the kitchen and rush to Mom's side. Fahad is not in his bed. Where is he? I just came in, Mom. I do not know, Anwar replies. Saqib was here before me, preparing breakfast. He might know. Saqib, do you? Saqib quickly bows his head to show that he doesn't know either. Mum directs Saqib to look for Fahad in the front and backyards, while she and Anwar search inside the house. No one can find him. Anwar and Saqib look pale. Sweat drips from Anwar's chin, and Saqib stutters each time he answers Mum. Dad usually wakes up at 9 on Fridays, but today he is already in the shower. Mom hopes to find Fahad safe and healthy by the time Dad comes out of the bathroom. She casts a glance at the servants. Anwar clasps his fist. Saqib's hands shake. They bow their heads in shame. When Dad approaches the breakfast table, our driver informs him that Fahad has gone missing. Dad rushes to the living room to question Mom and the servants. I don't dare say anything through my dry lips, even though I know it might help to find Fahad. My tongue swells and my feet feel numb. My mouth remains zipped, but my eyes stay wide open. I remain frozen to the spot like a statue. The doorbell rings. Mom, Dad, and the servants turn their heads towards the front door. A few seconds later, Mom finally walks across the room to answer the door. I hold my breath and stare across the family room to the main entrance. Mom opens the door. A fridge technician and two laborers wearing blue uniforms stand in the doorway. Our fridge stopped working the day before, and Mom had complained to the company. My parents and servants ignore them and continue searching for Fahad. Have you looked behind the fireplace? Dad asks Anwar. I did, sir, he replies. I'm going to check the laundry room now. Saqib left a pile of clothes there yesterday. Please do so, Dad responds in an annoyed tone. Saqib makes a move to open the humongous trunk in our storage room. I search my memory to see if we had played in it earlier in the morning. The squeaky noise of the broken lock assures me that Fahad is not hiding there. Mum, standing in the sitting area, bends down to look under the teakwood coffee table. Suddenly, she looks up, her face pink and lively, then stands and runs towards the kitchen. What happened to you now? Dad calls out. Mum doesn't respond. She rushes into the kitchen. Dad, Anwar, and Saqib follow. Abdullah and I don't dare to move an inch, but are curious to know what is happening. The laborers have the fridge on a dolly and are pushing it towards the back kitchen door. Stop, Mum yells. What? Says the technician. I said stop. Put the fridge down. They stand it back on the floor. Mum hurriedly opens the fridge door. Dad and the servants let out a gasp and place their hands over their mouths. The shock on their faces compels me to run into the kitchen. Fahad lies inside the fridge in the fetal position. His hands and face have turned a purplish blue. His eyes are closed. Fahad! Fahad! Wake up! Wake up, son! Mum pleads. Dad slowly rubs her back to calm her down. Is he dead or unconscious? What has happened to him? Please, somebody tell me what happened. Dad takes Fahad's limp body into his arms. His swollen arms dangle in the air. Mum and Dad rush Fahad to the hospital. Abdullah and I stay behind with the servants. Many hours go by. Dad contacts the servants by phone, but they don't update us on Fahad's condition. Anwar and Saqib look after us at home as instructed by my parents. Anwar supervises us. Saqib serves us lunch. I can't eat much. Nothing tastes good. Abdullah assists me in my math homework. I follow all his instructions, but out of guilt, I avoid eye contact with him and the other servants throughout the day. My parents return home Saturday morning with Fahad, nicely tucked in a white blanket, asleep inside Mum's folded arms. His cheeks are pink once again. I burst into tears. Dad and Mum hold me tight in their arms. "Are you okay, sweetie?" "I don't know, Daddy," I sob. "Hey, look at me." Dad squeezes my shoulders. "Aren't you my soldier?" "Your brother is fine, honey," he smiles. "Nothing to worry about." I finally gather up some courage and tell them what happened on Friday morning. Abdullah and I apologize and promise to never again do anything without their permission. Later, while Fahad is recovering, Abdullah and I quietly climb up to his bed. We whisper in his ears, "Sorry, Fahad," and hold his hands. "I will always take care of you, Fahad," Abdullah says. "I promise. And I'll do 1 week of your drawing class homework, and I'm not lying." My offer is the more attractive deal, I think to myself. Years later, my siblings and I gather at my parents' house in Mississauga. As usual, we tease Fahad about his many astonishing childhood accidents. Abdullah makes fun of him for the hide-and-seek scare. As always, it pisses off Fahad. He grinds his teeth and turns to Mum. "It's all your fault, Mum. You should not have left the door of an empty fridge open. Who does that? You should have locked it. It's definitely your fault." "Yes, I know it was my fault, honey. But who cares now? No point in complaining, since you are still alive." We all laugh.
That was Hide and Seek, written by Sadaf Saleem, read by Laurie Callis. In Sadaf's second story tonight, a young woman suffers severe injuries in a car accident. While she is in a coma, her brother's friend, who helps to nurse her, falls in love with her. Let's listen now to Sadaf Saleem's story, Ashar, read by Laurie Callis.
Ashar by Sadaf Saleem. I'm lying in my bed in the hospital when the phone rings. "Hello? Assalamu alaikum. May peace be upon you." "Wa alaikum assalam. May peace be upon you too." I don't recognize the voice. "Who is this?" "Oh, Ashar here. How are you doing today?" "I'm doing well, thanks." A pause. "So did the nurse change your dressing today?" Yes, she did." "Okay." Another pause. "So did you have your shrimp soup yet?" "No, I had it last night." Goosebumps raise the hair on my arms. Why is this guy calling me? "I don't think I'm going to have shrimp soup again today." Is anyone there with you?" I look around. Two black wooden chairs stand across from my hospital bed. Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and a sports car magazine sit on the table beside me. The intense June sun shines through the white sheer curtain into my eyes. I squint and turn my face away. A nurse in the hallway helps a patient who limps. "Watch out," she tells him. "Do not put too much stress on your foot. Use your quad muscles." "I'm trying, can't you see?" replies the patient through clenched teeth. "It hurts." The nurse holds his back tighter for further support, and they continue to walk. "Sadaf," Ashar breaks the silence. "I asked, is anyone there with you?" "Not at the moment. Dad went to pick up a cup of coffee for me. He'll be back soon." "Cool. Sounds good. Okay, listen, I gotta go. But please call me if you need me, or feel bored, or just for anything, okay? Thanks so much for the offer, but I'll be fine. Oh, I'm sure you'll do just fine, but I'm letting you know that I'll be available if need be. Okay, you take care now. I'll call you tomorrow, same time. Bye for now. Allah Hafiz. May God be your guardian. A dialed tone knocks my eardrum. I continue holding the old-fashioned, heavy black phone receiver in my right hand. A firm wedge cushion helps me stay upright in the bed. I can't feel my legs. With my left hand, I reach down and touch the stitches on my hip. The swollen area hurts and burns. Does Ashar know about my accident? Who told him? Who told him I like shrimp soup? We never talked to each other in high school. Who gave him my private hospital number? And why does he want to approach me anyway? On May the 5th, 2008, I had a catastrophic road accident at the intersection of Dixie and Burnhamthorpe Roads. I had left the University of Calgary 3 days before to visit my family in Mississauga and to celebrate my birthday with them on May the 7th. I suffered a brain injury, multiple broken ligaments, a dislocated knee and shoulder, a fractured femur, ankle, and facial bones, and uncountable bruises on my face and body. I was in a coma for 10 days. When I came out of the coma, 3.5 weeks of my life had been erased from my mind, and the brain injury had left the right side of my body weakened. Dad and my younger brother Fahad walked into the room. Here is your coffee, honey. Thanks, Dad. I reach out and grab the cup with my right hand. Fahad, Ashar just called me. Uh-huh. Does he know about my accident? I hold my breath. Oh, yeah, Fahad answers as he flips through the magazine. Ashar sounded as if he knows more than just about the accident. He talked frankly to me, not like we were talking for the first time. I stare at Fahad and wait for his response. That's because it's not the first time you guys have talked. Goosebumps break out in my arms. He was here in the hospital on the day of your accident. Abdullah was at his place in Waterloo when we informed him. Knowing that a brother couldn't stabilize himself after hearing such dreadful news, Ashar accompanied Abdullah to the hospital. He stayed in Mississauga for a week. He nursed you and helped us get through this ordeal. I'm crippled and helpless and I feel ugly. How must I have looked, Ashar, right after the accident? Arr, I scream. I have trouble holding the paper cup in my right hand. Hot coffee spills onto my swollen thigh. Dad and Fahad rush over to me with a towel. But I'm not deterred. I want to use my right hand every day, as much as possible, and regain my strength. 3 months later, I'm discharged from the hospital and back home. I have to attend ongoing private therapies, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech pathology, aquatherapy, and many others, to recover. It seems too much to handle, and I feel overwhelmed when the phone rings. Hey, what's up? Ashar says. I'm good, I smile to myself. I'm sure you drove all your therapists crazy once again today. Don't say no, because one of them just phoned me and complained about you. I chuckle at Ashar's teasing remarks. A phone call from Ashar at the end of a hectic, challenging day feels like a reward. I cherish seeing his name on the call display. I know he will appreciate my hard work and ongoing struggle. The next summer, Ashar gets accepted into the Sabah University School of Medicine. He visits us before leaving for the Caribbean. We have dinner together. My entire family respects Ashar and appreciates his support. They congratulate him and wish him good luck with his medical studies. I focus on regaining my health. My neurosurgeon tells me I can't go back to university. I want to prove him wrong. I need to exert a lot of effort to make it happen. I stay positive. I spend my energy and time and sacrifice my comfort to make it happen. In August 2010, my rehab team approves my request to attend college. They want me to start with a college course to assess my academic level. I enroll at Sheridan College for the fall semester and experience school life once again. I drag myself around campus in a wheelchair every day. Ongoing surgeries have weakened my legs. Every 10 to 15 minutes, Sarah, my support worker, reminds me to stand up, with her help, and stretch my legs. Otherwise, they grow numb. Even after following all the medical instructions, I still experience unbearable pain during lectures. My classmates stare at me. I must look like an alien to them. I accept the pain and the embarrassment attached to this bitter reality because I value education. In September, I prepare for the first test in the human anatomy course. Textbook and lecture notes lie scattered all over my study desk. I fall behind schedule. On the day of the test, my hands feel sweaty and cold. My head pounds. I had swallowed a painkiller earlier, but it doesn't work. I drop my pencil on the floor. At school, Sarah has to pick up my dropped pencil several times over the course of the class. But I'm at my study desk, alone, and I have to call someone to my room just to pick up my pencil. Why can't I do it myself? I feel like crying. I close my eyes tight and drop my head on the back of the chair. The phone rings. I look at my cell phone. Call display shows Ashar. It refreshes me. He calls me every 2 to 3 months just to stay in touch. Hey, I smile. Hi, how are you doing, tough girl? That's how Ashar usually addresses me. I want to say something to you, Sadaf. He sounds hesitant and yet serious. Do you have a minute? Sure, go ahead, I say. Do you like me? Of course, Ashar, is that even a question? I giggle. Everyone in my family likes you, and you know that very well. You are such a nice person. We're lucky to have you as a family friend, and... No, I didn't mean it that way, he cuts me off. I mean, do you like me differently, the way I like you? I'm not really sure what he's asking. I see myself spending my entire life with you, taking care of you, compensating for every pain you have been through. I will... Shut up. My heart throbs in my ears. My eyes bulge. I tighten my fists. I feel like heaving the white crystal glass on my night table at the glass mirror hanging on the wall. Who do you think you are? I don't need any sympathy. You must have thought, who will marry this piece of junk now? Let's show some fake kindness and pretend to be an angel so everyone in society will adore you, respect you, right? My hands shake. Tears fall down my cheeks. My face feels hot. We are friends, Sadaf. How could I even think what you have said? I swear to God, I didn't mean to hurt you. But you did. You did hurt me. What you just said was cheap. You think cheap. You are cheap. Stay away from me. Silence. Then Ashar dares to speak while I catch my breath. I'm sorry if I hurt you, Sadaf. I thought I would be a good match for you. But it seems like I'm totally not. But please forgive me and stay a good friend. I've learnt a lot from you. You inspire me. I'm so proud of you. Just forget what I've asked you. Let's stay the way we were before. Ashar tries his best to calm me down with his words, but they don't work. How could you insult me like that? I don't even know if I can handle college-level studies, I shouted him. And you think I would be a good match for a medical student? Huh, who are you kidding? Sadaf, I like you as a person. You're the most motivated and determined person I have ever met. I have no doubt in my mind that you can make it back to university. Even if you don't, I have no problem with that. Ashar continues trying to comfort me with his words. What counts is the hard work, passion, and sincerity you direct towards every task, not the outcome, which is driven by luck. If you have any other problem with me beyond that, then that's fine. Otherwise, your current education status is no valid excuse to me, Sadaf. Oh, just stop all this nonsense. This moral talk sounds good, but it's not practical. All bullshit. All this will be gone within a year if we live together. Okay, that's enough. I need to go back to my studies. Sadaf, I know you like me as a person, and you don't need to feel inferior because of your education. I know you can do it. Whatever. Then propose to me when that happens. Not now. I will. I know you can do it, and I'll ask you then. And by then, there shouldn't be any excuse from your end. Yeah, yeah. Ask me then. Whatever. I hang up the phone. I stare at the same water-filled white crystal glass. I don't have the energy to grab it. I need my codeine pill. My brain hasn't healed to the point where I can tolerate disputes and arguments. I look at my reflection in the wall mirror. My face is swollen. Time passes, and my anger and embarrassment fade. Ashar and I stay in touch, but we never talk about a possible relationship again. I focus mainly on my health and education. I have to. I hate feeling defeated. I can't give up without trying. I suffer through more surgeries and therapies while attending school. I hang on in the hope that it will pay off one day. I continue on my path with the strong, positive belief that everything happens for a reason. These challenges make me a new person. They teach me to be grateful and to not take anything for granted. I view the world differently. August 28, 2011. I sit in the family room in the evening watching Fast Five on TV with my sister. I turn to look at my ringing cell phone. The screen displays Ashar's name. I pick it up and grab my single-pointed cane to reach the stairlift. I sit down on the stairlift, and it carries me to the second floor of my house. My legs haven't recovered to the point where I can use them to climb the stairs. I reach my room and pick up Ashar's call. "Assalamu alaikum." "Wassalam," he quickly replies. "How are you?" I ask. "Not too bad. I heard something from Fahad yesterday." "What was it?" I frown. "You're going to York University this fall. Is that right?" "Yes, you heard it right." I blush. "Congratulations." "Thanks. I'm just grateful." A long pause. "So I'm waiting." "Pardon?" I said, "I'm still waiting. Waiting for your answer." "Answer to what?" "Would you be my life partner?" His voice sounds strong and steady. I feel perplexed and just as shocked as last time. We haven't talked about this in over a year. "What's wrong with you, Ashar? Didn't we just get over this? Listen, I can't be mad at you again. I seriously have no energy to do it all over again. I wanted you to focus on your health and studies, Sadaf, and I'm glad you did. I waited throughout that time period and didn't distract you. Now you're back to university. This time, only I will speak, and you will listen to me. Okay, fine," I cut him off. "I do like you. You have all the good qualities that any girl would fall for, but that is not enough. You know we belong to a culture that has its own values. What about your parents? Their will and opinions do matter. Would they ever accept me? What would you tell them, huh? You like a girl who can't walk without a walker? You like a girl who just holds a high school diploma? You like a girl who is struggling at the moment and might keep struggling forever? Is that what you will tell them?" I cry out. "Please tell them, because it is true. And I'll stay quiet, and you will get the answer from your parents this time." I hang up and throw my BlackBerry at the leopard print rug on the floor. I sit on the edge of my bed and cry. Crying usually comforts me, but this time it doesn't work. I take a sleeping pill to soothe me and knock me out. Next evening, my phone rings again. I hear the long-distance ringtone. A shiver runs down my spine. I quickly prepare what I want to say if it's Ashar calling again. The call display shows a phone number from the UK. Hello? It's Dr. Yasmin Kazi, Ashur's mum. I don't respond. Is that you, Sadaf? Mum, I can't do anything more than make a sound. I won't take much of your time, honey. I just have a few things to share with you. I came to Canada while you were hospitalized. I visited you and your family in the hospital. You might not recall this, nor do I want you to. She pauses. I'm trying to tell you that nothing is hidden from us about you. A year ago, Ashar shared his feelings about you to his dad and I. Ashar has well introduced you to us. We adore you. We already love you through Ashar. He promised us to respect you, to love you, to shield you. So how could he let you face any rejection from his own parents? Dr. Kazi's words penetrate me. They fill me with conflict. I can't decide how to react. I remain quiet. Ashar is my son, sweetheart. I want to see him happy. And you are the source of his joy. He pictures himself being happy with you, and we wholeheartedly welcome his joy to our family. The phone disconnects. I look at the armchair and drag my body towards it. I sit down and rest my feet on the footstool. I gently close my eyes.
That was Ashar, written by Sadaf Saleem and read for tonight's program by Laurie Callis. This concludes Life Rattle number 1315. I'm your host, John Dunford. Life Rattle was created by Ernie Ackman and Guy Allen. Be sure to tune in next week for our special East Coast program, hosted by Tracy Moniz, featuring the writing of Jamie Gillingham and Robin Young.